Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
More building societies look set to merge, so what does this mean for your savings? If you thought you'd have to wait until 68 to retire, think again. And bonuses are back, but what about mortgages based on bonus income? All this to come in this week's FT Money Show. I'm Matthew Vincent, I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with my colleagues from FT Money, Steve Lodge, Charlene Goff.
Hello.
And our special studio guest, Andy Tully, Senior Pensions Policy Manager at Standard Life.
Hello.
So let's start with this week's money news. Just when you thought the dust had settled on the crisis-hit bank and building society sector, and it was back to business as usual, more unsettling news has emerged. This week, there has been growing speculation that two of the largest building societies, Chelsea and Stroud and Swindon, may seek mergers or financial restructuring following the surprise departures of both of their chief executives. Chelsea, the fifth largest society, is considering whether to merge with another one or issue a controversial new type of equity as part of a full review of strategy. Stroud and Swindon, the tenth largest mutual lender, insists it's not in a distress situation, but rivals say that it's going to have to pull a strategic partner out of the hat. Steve, you've been following the story all week. Should we, as savers or borrowers, be at all worried by the news?
No, Matthew. I think in the sense that savers' cash is safe. Furthermore, there are still far too many building societies out there, so I think we can all miss a few without noticing. But the other side of this, the good news that people used to hope for with building society consolidation is on windfalls. I don't think there's any real chance of windfalls here in whatever deals may emerge. And we really are at the early stages of these changes.
And I realise that, yes, there's a review going on at Chelsea, and Stroud and Swindon is saying that it's not in distress. But people are talking about possible restructurings, which suggests that certain smaller building societies, although these are pretty reasonably sized, are still struggling to basically keep their finances together.
Absolutely, Matthew. I mean, the building society sector is a sort of real economy sector compared to the banks, which were really hit by the kind of the incomprehensible end of the credit crisis that, you know, came across from the Atlantic, the whole subprime crisis and so on. Well, building societies are what we know they are, which is they lend money to people, and sometimes they lend money to people they shouldn't do. So they really start to get hit when bad debts rise, so on their mortgages and so on. At the same time, they're all struggling with this low base rate that is great news for borrowers and actually isn't that bad a news for savers at the moment. They're struggling because Stroud and Swindon, for example, says one in seven of its borrowers is on a tracker rate that in some cases could be as low as 1.5%. And it's just saying it's very difficult to make money out of that when it's very difficult to make money when you're only getting that much back from borrowers and you're having to pay much higher rates to savers just to keep their cash in.
So in terms of what might happen, I suppose we can look to some of the precedents that have been set in the sector. I'm thinking of both Derbyshire and the West Bromwich. Can you remind us what happened in those cases?
Yes, I mean, despite the sort of propaganda put out by the mutual movement, we've actually lost seven societies so far. There have been seven mergers or takeover societies in the credit crisis, and one, what even the industry association calls a quasi-demutualisation of the West Bromwich building society when it issued these what are called incomprehensibly profit-participating deferred shares, but these are shares issued to institutional investors that pay away some of the profits of the society. Now, mutual diehards, and frankly, anyone who believes in the concept of building societies looking after savers and borrowers, thinks, well, if you're paying profits out, what's the difference between that and a bank? Well, indeed, say many people. So this is why it's described as a quasi-demutualisation. But it's seen as a useful form of capital restructuring, cutting the interest charges that societies would have otherwise have to pay to those institutional investors.
So it clearly helps the societies, but what about two groups of people? Firstly, savers, and secondly, holders of permanent interest-bearing shares, or PIBs, in building societies?
Yes, I mean, it's much like, as Andy, I'm sure, will tell us about the life insurance world, is, you know, the incomprehensible title. PIBs, call them a bond. Call them a fixed interest security. Now, in fact, Stroud and Swindon and Chelsea don't have PIBs in this case, but these sorts of events are going to unsettle the PIBs market again, because people fear that the coupon, the interest paid on those PIBs, will be cut, as was the case in the West Bromwich restructure. In terms of savers, yes, savers and borrowers, yes, the fear is if these PPDS were issued, then rates would suffer over time. That's a fear. It's difficult to tell because we don't have enough experience at the moment. But what we could well see, I mean, the safe money basically is on Stroud and Swindon being taken over, regardless of what it says. It's too small, really, even though it's the 10th biggest building society. And Chelsea probably surviving. It's got a very, very experienced new temporary chief executive who's come from the Nationwide, and that's more likely to go down the financial restructure route, the PPDS route.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Stephen. You can read more about what's happening at Chelsea and Stroud and Swindon Building Societies and what it means for societies generally in Steve's article in FT Money with the Weekend FT and online at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, bonuses. Will mortgage lenders take them into consideration? First, though, pensions. This week, retirement got further away for all of us. According to the pensions regulator, plans to raise the retirement age to 68 by 2050 will not be enough to solve the pension funding crisis. So people will undoubtedly, and those are his words, not mine, have to work for even longer. The government seems to agree. It's already said that it's bringing forward its review of the default retirement age to next year. But now the European Court of Justice has got involved, telling the UK High Court that an enforceable retirement age can only remain if it has a legitimate aim linked to social or employment policy. So where does all of this leave us when we're trying to plan our pensions? Well, who better to answer that question than Andy Tully from Standard Life. Andy, What does the default retirement age actually mean? Let's establish that first.
Okay, the default retirement age means that an employer can effectively force an individual out of the door, even if they don't want to retire. And that's currently age 65 in the UK. So people can keep on working up to age 65. At that date, they can be forced to retire, even if they don't want to.
I suppose a key thing to remember here is that the default retirement age is not necessarily the pension age, the age at which you can take your pension.
Absolutely. That comes really down to the individual scheme that someone's a member of, or if they have a personal contract, they might be able to take benefits from 55. And the rules are much more flexible in the UK now, that people can take benefits and keep on working. So yeah, absolutely, people need to remember that it doesn't mean that they can't take retirement benefits until that age. It just means that there might be some restrictions around when they can actually work.
But, of course, the reason that this debate about the retirement age is being waged is because of the funding shortfalls that exist in both employers' schemes and in, you know, individuals' personal schemes. What's the general advice for people who are worried about having a shortfall in their scheme and not being able to retire when they want to?
I think all of this shows that there's effectively a triple whammy of things coming along as people are living longer than they used to do. State pension benefits are not as generous as they used to be, and many people have inadequate pension saving of their own. So taken together, these things mean that people will either have to accept to retire on less money in retirement and live on less money, or they have to delay retirement and keep on working for a longer time.
And so, depending which one of those individuals you are, looking to retire earlier or looking to work longer, I suppose flexibility in your pension planning arrangements is going to be even more important.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things we're seeing is that the traditional retirement patterns where you worked for one company for 40 years, got a gold watch on the Friday and were retired from the Monday onwards, these days are largely gone. And many more people are gradually easing into retirement, so they might move to part-time working, they might take on charity work, all sorts of different things. So people don't necessarily want to take all of the pension benefits at once. They might want to take some of it. They may just want to take a lump sum, which might help them with a business venture or to go on holiday or pay off debt. So yes, we absolutely need much more flexibility to fit in with people's lifestyles.
So, let's say that I want this flexibility because I'm not sure what's going to happen to me at the FT. So, what sort of scheme should I be in? I'm actually in the FT pension scheme, and I'm not sure what the details are for when I can take benefits. I should check that. But what's the most flexible type of scheme?
The most flexible scheme for a type of retirement benefits is probably a self-invested personal pension or SIP, as the industry calls it. These allow people to defer income or take a lump sum and take no income. They allow people to take a little bit of income if they want to. So they allow lots of flexibility. But what that does mean is that there's more options and more complications. So generally, people need to have a little bit more money to have a SIP, a little bit more pension saving, and they generally need to take advice as well.
And for people who are in occupational schemes, I suppose the question then arises, should I transfer into a SIP for the added flexibility, or should I look to make other arrangements in addition to my occupational scheme?
Yes, that's a much more difficult question.
That's why I'm asking it.
Generally, if people are in a defined benefit scheme, then due to guarantees and the valuable benefits people get from them, then in many cases it's not worthwhile transferring, certainly not in advance of retirement. Transferring just at retirement might be an option. But yes, there's no doubt that SIP does give added flexibility that people do to desire. But I guess as an industry and with government as well, that we do need to encourage more flexibility in all types of pension schemes.
But Andy, I mean, strangely enough, the pension company wants us to buy more SIPs. That's a little bit unfair. I know you were quite measured. But haven't we heard recently as well that annuity incomes are likely to fall as well? So all this wonderful pension saving that you and others encourage us to do, aren't we going to be hit by much lower annuity rates because of various complicated solvency issues in addition to the longevity, i.e. pensions may not be the panacea for retirement saving?
I think pensions are one part of a package of measures that people need. I mean, the key question is, do people have enough income in retirement? How they wish to generate that income can be in a whole series of ways, whether that's ISAs, whether that's property, whether that's pensions. But I think a pension, due to its tax reliefs, is a valuable part of that package. So I think people should look at it very carefully. Going back to your point on annuities, yes, with people living longer, that does mean that if you have a pot of money, you're going to live longer, you get less each year. That's simple arithmetic. And yes, EU rules are likely to mean that will go down in future as well.
And Andy, just finally, what's your money on for default retirement age? 70? 75?
I think the likelihood is that we won't have a default retirement age in future. I think we'll get to a position that people will have the ability to work as long as they want to, or perhaps more important, as long as they need to.
Indeed. And we'll all need a lot of flexibility with our pension arrangements then. So thanks very much for that. Andy. And what do you think about the default retirement age? You can join in the debate or read the views of other FT Money readers and various pension experts on our new blog, ft.com/moneymatters. Look out for Lucy Warwick-Ching's post called Should the Default Retirement Age Be Scrapped? And then click on the comments button. I'll give you those details again at the end of the show. And finally today, mortgages. Apparently, there is a new acronym being heard all around the City of London, BAB, which is short for Bonuses Are Back. It's not being heard here at the FT, where bonuses certainly are not back if they were here in the first place. But if you are a lucky banker getting a bonus this year, can it actually help you get a bigger mortgage? Charlene, this is a subject that you've been following, you know, for some time, and we've seen lenders' attitudes to counting bonuses change over that period. What's the situation like now?
Well, I think for lenders, bonuses definitely are not back, and they really don't seem to have any more appetite to take bonuses into account when offering mortgages. Before the credit crunch really happened, banks on the high street, as well as the private banks, were very happy to take bonuses into account and would actually encourage people to boost their income so they could borrow more and buy bigger properties. And most lenders would take at least half and often 100% of a bonus into account when calculating how much they could borrow. That's really changed quite dramatically now, and lenders, if they take bonuses into account at all, may only use, say, a quarter of the bonus that has been paid in previous years. They might also want confirmation that the bonus is guaranteed, and there might be other changes, such as some lenders will no longer take overtime into account and commission and parts of income like that that aren't guaranteed. So it's much harder if your income is not just your basic salary to get a mortgage.
I suppose this affects quite a lot of people. While listeners' hearts may not go out to the banking community, there are lots of other professions where income comes in the form of commission and bonuses. And I suppose this has really restricted their ability to get the loans they need.
Yes, it really has. I mean, you've got all sorts of professions, from estate agents to recruitment people. Lots of different industries rely on bonuses and actually have very comparatively low basic salaries. So when you're sort of stripped right down to your basic guaranteed, it might just be a third of your total income or even less. And that's what you can base a mortgage on. So it's proved very difficult and actually has stopped a lot of people being able to borrow enough to buy the house they need. Mortgage brokers are saying that they expect lenders to relax their criteria gradually. I think we need a bit more evidence that bonuses are coming back and bonuses are reliable, because they're very nervous at the moment that you have all this speculation that bonuses are coming back. But of course, banks and other companies have the right to withdraw that at any time, so they don't want to start lending on something that could disappear. But I think once we see bonuses coming through and being paid for another 6 months or another year, they might start to relax criteria, so things should get a little easier, but not in the foreseeable future.
I know that you've been talking to some of the sort of top-end lenders, if you like, this week. Is there any indication that some of them may be relaxing criteria, as you've just suggested, for certain of their wealthier clients?
Well, I think definitely private banks have been more amenable to using bonus income, and actually they haven't really scaled back their appetite to do that in the last year or so. They supply loans on a much more bespoke basis, and they know the client well, and so they have been willing to take bonuses into account. And actually, we're hearing that some of the private banks are showing a greater willingness to lend on bonuses, because there's this big demand and a pool of clients who really can't get mortgages elsewhere. So they are saying, I mean, it's people like banks like SG Ambrose are sort of saying that it's willing to do more mortgage lending and to accommodate people with bonuses to help them out, really, because their clients can't go anywhere else. And then they would look to build wider relationships with their clients. So it's a way in. And that's been quite typical of the private banks recently. So we've got the money, we can lend, but we want a relationship and we want some control over your other assets, is the general principle.
And that's the big problem, I suppose, for those who may not be wealthy enough to transfer all of their investments and assets to a private bank, but they're still reliant on commission, say, for a lot of their income.
Yes, exactly. Those people may have troubles for some time. I mean, some of the banks don't have very high, don't impose very high demands. You know, they just want some idea that you know they can build a relationship with you in future. So it's not for the super wealthy only, but it's not for everyone, and there will be people who will struggle to obtain finance for some time.
It's certainly worth finding out who will take your bonuses into account. So thanks for that, Charlene. And if you'd like to know more about those lenders and their attitudes to bonuses and commission and who is prepared to lend more, look out for Charlene's article in FT Money this weekend. Well, that's all for this week's FT Money show. Remember, you can find all of these stories and weekday news on our website, ft.com/money. And you can read and comment on our latest blog posts at ft.com/money matters. You can even follow us on Twitter, whatever that may be, from that very web page. And we'll be back next week with another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Steve, Charlene, and Andy Tully of Standard Life.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.